This is a strange lesson. But well, maybe you're just used to that by now. They're all strange some way or another. But it's a little different way of looking at things. And I think we can't talk too long about families and leadership and spiritual guidance without thinking about how we make decisions. And that's hard. That's a hard thing to do. Already, people have talked to me about difficult decisions that maybe these sessions, or maybe they're just so much a part of your life that you just wrestle with it. You know, what about the possibility of serving in some public civil office? That's come up. Or how to deal with family members that are struggling, but you want to help them, but you don't want to enable them. You know, those difficult. These are hard decisions, aren't they? But I will ask this question to get started. Did anybody on their way here wrestle with the decision to stop on the way and rob a convenience store? Anybody wrestle with that decision? Okay. We'll help you overcome that habit if you want to work on it. And how about, did anybody wrestle with the temptation to beat somebody up and kill them this afternoon? I'm not counting siblings. But I mean, generally, has that been an issue in your life? At my age, I'm kind of over that one, right? And really, it is the case that most of our decisions, most of them, really, are not about hard things, moral decisions. You know what I mean? Right and wrong. We just, that's not, now we have some of those. Oh, we have temptations. We know it would be wrong to do this. Or after we've done something, maybe in a rash way, we realize that was a bad choice. It was wrong. It was sinful. We kind of know what to do about that. But most of the decisions in our life are really not obvious choices between good and evil. Do I have to talk more to convince you of that? That sounds like a threat, doesn't it? Okay, well, I won't talk anymore. And I would even say that most of the major decisions in our lives are really not clear moral choices. I mean, think about what they are. What job are you going to take? Where are you going to build your house? How much are you going to spend on the house, right? Whether we should do this, eat at this restaurant or that one. Those are not big decisions, but some of the others are. Where shall I go to college? What shall I study? Even things like who shall I marry, are they always obvious choices between good and evil, wrong and right, moral and immoral? You see, they're really not. And so it's puzzling to know, so how do I address that? And sometimes we think that maybe the reason it isn't a choice between good and evil is because maybe some choices are maybe the religious side of my life, but some choices are the, I don't know, what's the word we like, secular, right? Or this is my private business. This is my personal business. This is the area of freedom and, you know, and what do we call it? Judgment or something like that. But this is the area of faith and right and wrong and sin. Is that really the way life is? Well, I think we have that model sometimes in our minds. And there's a phrase, I do like this at home, and everybody knows what that means. There's this rhythmic kind of musical phrase we use a lot called in and of itself. Can we practice that? You ready? In and of itself. You know how we use that phrase? Oh, it's not wrong in and of itself. You heard that before? And the idea is I can do it or not do it. It's okay, right? Unless I do it in some sinful way or something like that. But how many things in our life are really in and of themselves? How many really are? That's my question and what I'm trying to get at. And if you think I'm going to make your life simpler, but it probably won't be. But I hope to transform maybe the way we look at decisions to a different way of looking at it. Maybe that will help in some way. And I hope it's scriptural as well. And you know, if you look at the world this way, that some choices are kind of like up to me and God doesn't care. He left it to my freedom or my rights or something like that. I wonder if it sometimes it maybe puts my off about. Is that really what God talked about as a living sacrifice? You know, what's left over after the living sacrifice? Well, it's everything. That's all there is. But it does lead to questions like this. Is it a sin to? Have you ever heard questions like that? And fill in the blank with all that you'd like to, right? Do you think it's a sin to miss one worship service? Even a Wednesday night when the teacher's pretty bad and I have a headache. And the kids are tired, and there's school tomorrow, and there might be snow on the road, and so on. Is that a sin? Y'all have had these questions asked? You young people never say that. Do you think it's wrong too, right? Let's put some more up here. Take one drink. Here's another form of that question. Show me the Bible verse where it says, right? And what's our hope when we're asking the question that way? Are we hoping there will be a Bible verse that says that? No, we're hoping there isn't one. And if there isn't one, then I say, well, there you go. You're just adding to the text. That's an area of personal freedom and liberty, right? Watch a movie. In one movie. Is that a sin? Are you feel uncomfortable when that question's asked? And if you're like me, my mind starts kind of going through the verses that I know. Well, what could I apply? I mean, there must be some principle that I can call an analogy or some Old Testament example that, you know, that I could bring in. You see, you feel that pressure, don't you? Is it a sin to? And you're kind of thinking, it's probably not a good thing to do, but I don't know how to prove it's wrong. You ever had that? That's where you are. To go to establishments where there's drinking, though I don't drink. To date a non-Christian. Now we're getting into some more major decisions. Where does it say it's wrong? Do you think it's a sin too? Y'all hear these kind of questions before? Here's the great thing. Before this lesson's over, I'm going to tell you the answer to all these questions. You're laughing at me. You're not either. I am. Is it wrong to get a tattoo? To divorce an unfaithful spouse? Is that a sin to someone who's been unfaithful? To divorce them? Is that a sin? We had a discussion of rights the other day. There's a sense that there must be a verse that talks about the right to divorce. I don't know where that verse is. You show it to me afterwards. The right. We have, as we mentioned, the men's, we have one right that God's given us, and it's the right to become sons of God. That's what he says in John. The other rights we ought to often question, like the ones that Paul gave up for the gospel. Spend a large portion of my time on entertainment. Binge watching TV shows, is that a sin? You see what I'm getting at here, all right? We'll come back to these at the end. You get the idea. That's why there's lots of dots. You can ask lots of questions like this. I want to start with a premise. I'm going to talk three verses to convince you of this, and I'm going to build on that premise. What is it really in the Bible? In the New Testament in particular, there's really a description of only two ways of thinking, two motives in the world. Romans 8 is quite clear. There's the flesh, and then there's the spirit. And it's really, Paul doesn't say, and then there's this area of shade, or, you know, there are things that are, you know, they're all by themselves, in and of themselves, they don't matter. There's two ways of thinking. Those who live according to the flesh, they set their mind on the things of the flesh. Those who live according to the spirit, the things of the spirit. Okay, that's what they think about. To be carnally minded is death. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. If Christ is in you, the body is dead. And I believe that means the influence of that fleshly side. I believe that's what that's referring to. Because of sin, but the spirit, that's the part that resonates with the will of God, is alive because of righteousness. And if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Jesus from the dead, that demonstrates the power of that spirit, will also give life to your mortal bodies. I actually don't think he's talking about physical resurrection there one day. But I think that's demonstrated in Jesus' resurrection. I think it's saying that same power that pulled Jesus out of the tomb after having been crucified can actually be executed in your life if that spirit is in you. And that mortal body, which is influencing you toward the flesh, that influence can be quashed, overcome. And those are two ways of thinking. Whether you agree with my interpretation or not, you see there's two ways of thinking here, flesh and spirit. Philippians 3. As many as are mature have this mind, and if anything you think otherwise, God will reveal it even to you. Nevertheless, to the degree that we have already attained, let us walk by the same rule. Let us have the same mind. Brethren, join in following my example, and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping. Do you think these are Christians he's about to describe? I think we mourn over the lost people of the world, but don't we mourn over Christians that are kind of headed in the wrong direction? That brings us to tears because we know what they've given up. And we know the warning of the Hebrew writer that, you know, if you turn away, there's not another sacrifice for sin. There's not another path. A certain fearful expectation of judgment and fierceness of fire is the way he described it. Anyway, but whoever these people are, they are the enemies of the cross. Their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. What does that mean? I always think of the statue of Buddha with the guy looking down in his belly, but that's not what I think the idea is. What is God is their belly? What's the implication there? What's at the heart of what they worship?
Flesh.
desires, appetites, the physical side of things, pleasure, happiness, whatever it would be, but it's the immediate gratification of what my senses are. I think that's exactly right. Is that a way of living and thinking? That's the heart of what you're really for? And I think if you don't understand about God and judgment and Jesus' sacrifice, that's all you really have to hold on to. We've talked about that more earlier. Their glory is their shame, who set their mind on earthly things, but our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for a Savior and so on. Okay, one more verse. And that's Colossians 3. And you might just say, well, yeah, that's a lot of things are in that category, but not everything. There's still some things in my life, my choices I make. He says, if you were raised with Christ, implication, yes, you were, seek those things which are above where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Put to death your members, and these have to do with following those desires of the flesh, and put on in place of that, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts. And then what does he say? And by the way, this is the verse right before he moves into family relationships and things where you would apply these texts about what your new character looks like. It's really the parallel to what we looked at last night in Ephesians, really. If you can put on and put off all these things, now let's apply it to real world relationships. But before he says that, he says what? Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, and whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus. What does that mean, in the name of? Does that mean I just chant the name of Jesus when I do something? Of course not. What does it mean? By his authority, in his service, as he would wish me to do. All those kinds of ideas is, I'm doing this as a part of my service. In how many things in life? How many? The little things, the big things, all of them. You see that? Well, how does that relate to all those questions we ask about, do you think it's a sin to you? How do we relate those things? And so to answer that, I'd like to take a look at the Apostle Paul and the way he made a decision in the Spirit. And I'll set up the story a little bit. You probably know the story. It's on the third journey. And you remember the third journey ended with Paul going, I'll try to do this backwards, going from Asia Minor over into Greece, and then coming back with and collecting the money, and then going back to Jerusalem. I can't think backward well enough to do that. I think Jerusalem's over here, isn't it? In your world. Well, anyway, he collected the money, met with the Ephesian elders, that was the end of the third journey. So in the third journey, Paul starts off, I believe, doing what he wished he might have done in the second journey, but the Macedonian fellow called him, over to... But he went straight to Ephesus. He had good success in Ephesus. He told the elders, I've been there for 3 years. I set an example. The word was spread. I believe the churches, say Colossae and others, were established during that time. Maybe the word spreading out of Ephesus, which was his home base, that's described there. About 3 years spent there. And the word grew mightily. And at that point, Paul, I think he was thinking, well, I've done what I should do here. I've done what I can. I need to look to the future. I need to make a decision. And this is the verse that kind of describes that. When these things were accomplished, Paul purposed in the Spirit. Now, the New King James capitalizes the Spirit, but that's not, it may or may not be in the Greek. I don't know if that's the Holy Spirit. I think it's not. I think it means Paul in his own spirit decided this. I think he thought it through. And do you think Paul was deliberate about what he did next? Well, I think so. It was a big decision. I mean, it's kind of like similar to what job shall I take or where will I move to next and all that. I think he thought about it a lot. Well, how did he think about it? And if you don't believe that it was... Now, it is true. Paul did get a vision occasionally that helped him out. Like the Macedonian guy called. I think he had a t-shirt that said, I don't know what, Macedonian Mastodons or something. That's how Paul knew he was from Macedonia. That was a joke. It never worked very well. Somehow Paul knew this, a man from Macedonia, saying, come. That was helpful, right, on the second journey to know what to do. I think when he was in Corinth, he seemed kind of nervous, and the Spirit said, calm down. Nobody's going to hurt you here. Boy, I wish he'd say that to me. You know what I mean? Wouldn't that build some confidence? Those were things that I think God or the Spirit helped Paul with, but I don't think the Spirit's helping him this decision. I think Paul's putting together what he knows is right to do in his life and coming up with this decision. And here's a kind of a proof of that. If you know the story of what happened, here's what Paul said he was going to do. When he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, that's back over to Greece, right? I think that would be over here in your world, right? Is that right? Yes. And he said, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and after that, what? Going to Rome. Did it happen that way? How long was he in Caesarea in prison? 2 years, right? And he got to Rome, but not this way. And we'll find out more about what his plan was for going to Rome and why he was going to Rome in just a minute. We'll look at that. I think this plan did not work out the way Paul intended. And that to me is a little bit of an evidence that the Holy Spirit may not have been giving him this suggestion, right? It just didn't work out that way. And we'll come back to that idea in a little bit. Whereas when the Holy Spirit said something was going to happen, it happened. And you could count on that being a regular thing. But however it was, Paul decided to go to Jerusalem and finally to see Rome. You know, I would like to go to Rome. I've heard a lot of good things about it. I've never been there. I hear the weather's great. And I think the food's pretty good. And there are a lot of sites there that would be very interesting. Archaeological sites, wonders of architecture and all of that. Wouldn't that be fun to go to Rome? You think that's why Paul wanted to go to Rome? Mediterranean vacation, a little R&R after all that, those three journeys and all that. I'm for that. But so is it wrong to go to Rome? Is there such a thing as going to Rome in and of itself? No, there's always a reason for what we do things, and that's kind of where we are. So from Ephesus then, where Paul made this decision, he went to Greece. It took him about 3 months, and I think it was during that time, the collection, the plan for getting that money. Then he got in a hurry. He said, I got to get to Jerusalem before Pentecost. Perhaps that gift would have its greatest effect during a feast time when lots of Jews were around. I don't know why, but he was in a hurry to get there. And so while he was in Greece, that's, in Achaia, it looks like Romans, the letter, was written from, I think, maybe Corinth or the twin port city of Cenchrea or something, because he's describing this very decision and why he made it in the book of Romans in both the first chapter and the 15th chapter, right? Not the last one, but the next to last. Yeah, so that's what we'll look at. And you're going to help me. So if you've got a book, you need one of these books to fill out, because I want you to psycho-evaluate the Apostle Paul and why he wanted to go to Rome. Because there's a lot of information in those two chapters about why Paul was wanting to go to Rome. And then he returned through Macedonia, back up. I think his original plan might have been to sail, but there was a plot of the Jews. He may have been trying to steal the money, I don't know. But he went back up through Macedonia and collecting the gifts, and then Ephesian elders, and then back to Jerusalem. Okay, that's kind of the way that goes. All right. There's the decision. Before we, if you got your book, open it up to the notebook. You can look at page 20. Thank you. Whatever that is. You'll start, there's a worksheet with a bunch of blanks down the right-hand side. Yeah, page 20. And I want to look at a couple of verses which I think maybe were the foundation for why Paul did anything he did. So you could kind of say whatever he decided to do, that this was one of the basic reasons for it. And you can see that in these verses. So I'm thinking the one thing that he said in 2 Corinthians 5, in which he kind of implies, some people think we're crazy. That's okay. I'm not trying to please them. I'm trying to please the Lord. That's what he's saying in this verse, whether we're beside ourselves or not. But he says, but we make it our gain, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to him. Why? Because we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that we may each one receive the deeds done, and the things done in the body, according to what's good or bad. So if you can figure it out, what would be the reason Paul did anything that you'd put beside that? I'd just probably put, please God. So everything ought to have that basis to it, right? So something like that. And then there's another thing that I think maybe made Paul unique, we should probably include, and that is, do you remember when the Spirit appeared to, I always can't remember, to Philip or Ananias? Ananias was the one that was sent to Paul, right? To Saul when he was blind. And what did he say? What did the Spirit said? Go work with this guy Saul, right? He's in Damascus, he's blind, right? And what was Ananias' answer to that? Right, exactly. What? You want me to talk to who? And he kind of, almost like maybe the Spirit didn't know this, but I, he's the kind of a bad guy. But the Spirit said, no, no, there's something special about this man. And the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear the name before Gentiles. And that seemed to be a special mission of Paul. It comes up several times in his writing. Kings and children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. And I would say simply that is preach Christ to Gentiles, right? And I guess we all have an evangelistic responsibility, but do you see that Paul, the 13th apostle, whatever, had this special assignment to go take the gospel to Gentiles in particular? And you can see kind of the conflict and how that plays itself out later in Acts chapter 15 and so on when he comes back, and his success among the Gentiles is a powerful argument. Okay, now do you see the game we're playing here? Look at these verses, and now we're going to look at verses from that Roman letter written from Corinth, Cenchrea, as he was beginning to implement this plan he made, which was, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and then I'm going to go to... Oh, wait a minute. That's in there, actually. Shh. That's coming. Right. I'm going to go to Rome. Can you find some reasons in here? And if you can, just take a minute and fill out those blanks down the right-hand side. And hint, they roughly correspond vertically with the reasons that are in the text, okay? So try to figure that out. If you take a minute or two and see if you can do that. Y'all have workbooks? You need? I think there's a few left. This first page is Romans 15. I think the next page will be Romans 1. I think they're both on the page in the workbook. They're reversed. Romans 1 and 15. Okay, we'll do it in this order. Doesn't matter. We'll figure it out. Yeah, we'll do 15 first. All right, let's see how you do. Let's do this Romans 15 here. Well, actually, at the bottom of the page, maybe you haven't gotten there yet. Maybe we should wait a minute. By the way, thanks for participating. I know this is weird. This is to fill this out, but help me with this. Maybe they're too easy. Maybe they're too hard. I don't know. All right, let's see what reasons you come up with. Romans 15. I've so made it my aim to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build on another man's foundation. Skip to 22. For this reason, I also have been much hindered from coming to you. That puzzles me a little bit. Do you mean by that someone had tied Paul down to the ground and not let him go to Rome? Could it physically have been possible for him to get to Rome if he really wanted to and that was his highest priority? What do you think? I think so. What does he mean he was hindered from coming? I think it must mean there must have been a higher priority or something. That's all I can think of it meaning. I don't think it means he was physically handicapped or imprisoned or something like that. We'll see some similar references. But now, no longer having a place in these parts, and I don't think that means they're kicking him out. I think he means my work's kind of done. And maybe that's a hint about what the priorities are, why he was hindered in some way. I don't know. Having a great desire these many years to come to you. Well, Paul, if you wanted to go that bad, why didn't you just go? You see the sense of priority that's been set up till now, and now the priority has risen up a little bit. Are things in our life like that when we make decisions? We've been thinking about doing this, thinking about doing this, and suddenly either a time limit or a last chance opportunity or a real good opportunity, and so... priorities change, and we decide that's what we're going to do. I think that's the way. I hope to see you on my journey and be helped on my way to you. I think I skipped verse 24, which we'll get to. Well, so list some of these reasons. What did you hear? What did you see there in verse 20 say? What were his reasons to go to Rome? Okay, to preach the gospel, but more particularly, what kind of preaching was he hoping to do?
Foundation.
Well, to be a foundation, But actually, in this case, he's saying he does not want to build on another man's foundation, which means maybe he wants to put his own foundations. That, I mean, that's what your point was. What's he want? Who's he wanting to preach to?
People haven't heard it before.
That's what I believe. That's what it's saying, isn't it? He wants to go somewhere where Christ was not named. Were there Christians in Rome already? Well, yeah. Well, okay. But I think that's right. He wants to preach where Christ was not named. Maybe we can figure that out a little bit better. Okay, what about down in verse 24? What's the reason there? Verse 24.
We hope to go to Spain.
What does Spain have to do with anything? How did Spain get into this story? Is Spain, like, where is it? On the way to Rome or farther away from Rome? And how does Rome relate to Spain, really? For Paul, I know these questions are too weird.
Well, Rome would be a stopover on his way to Spain.
It's on the way. It's a waypoint. In fact, we're going to learn more about how it's a really kind of advantageous waypoint. And there are a lot of other good reasons for stopping there, right? To stop in Rome. Wait, stop in Rome on the way to... What do you think his ultimate goal might have really been? Given he kind of been hindered and he wanted to, but he never did go to Rome. What might have been his bigger goal, really? Given he wanted to preach the gospel where Christ had not been named. Probably Spain. That was where, I think that's where Paul was trying to get to. Now, he was explaining to them why he was coming to Rome, but part of that explanation was, I preach the gospel if I can, where I'm laying a foundation nobody's been there before. And you're on the way. And we're going to see exactly that language. Keep on reading. I hope to see you, what, on my journey. Not, you know, you are my journey. And be helped on my way there by you. There's another advantage. What would that be? Give me help to go to Spain. It's a waypoint, but they might actually put him up, give him some money to help him on his way, a lot of things that way. But he says, at first, before that, I may enjoy your company for a little while. I'm going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. That's in between. Therefore, when I've performed this, have sealed this fruit, I shall go by way of you to Spain. Are you getting a hint here? Go by way of you to Spain. And finally, while I'm there, another reason to go to Rome is to be refreshed by you. Do you see we're looking kind of into the way Paul thinks about a decision, which I think is not a right or wrong decision. It's just how shall I manage my life given these goals and mission that God has given me. I told you this was going to be a weird lesson. Well, stick with me for a little while. All right, let's go to chapter 1. What are some reasons that you see there? God is my witness, whom I serve in my spirit, that without ceasing I make mention always of you in my prayers, making request if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. And I keep asking the question, I think he could have gone if he really, really wanted to go there and that was his highest priority. For I long to see you. Why? What could he do if he got to Rome? What are some other reasons he could be there? You see, they're all in yellow. It can't be that hard. It's not.
Part of spiritual gift.
Yeah, to the saints that are there. And Paul had the ability to do that. Others didn't, and there probably was maybe a need for that. That would be helpful for the church there, and so on, right? And he would be encouraged together with you. I don't want you to be unaware that I've often planned to come to you, but was hindered till now. We heard that before. But that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. I'm debtor to the Greeks and barbarians, both to the wise and unwise, and I'm ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. Okay, some questions about these. You see all these? I've just collected them all on one page there. I wonder if there's some way these relate to each other and maybe can be organized in some way. So I have some questions to ask about it. I don't know if you remember if they're on the slides or not. Are some of these reasons enablers of other reasons? That is, they're related, but if I do this, then I can do this other thing. Is that, you see that? Yeah, I think going to Rome was enabling going to Spain, right? And those kind of things. So that would be one. Are some of these more incidental than others? I probably should ask that in a relative way. That just, they happen because I'm doing something already. I've already made the decision, but here's a great benefit of doing that. I'm going to be coming through Rome anyway. While I'm there, I'll be encouraged by you. Or I can impart some spiritual gifts. Or while I'm there, I can encourage you with preaching of the gospel. Do you see that? Am I stretching a little bit here? And before, those reasons were there, but they weren't sufficient to get Paul to make that decision to go to Rome. But now they are. Since he's going that way, he's able to do it. Do some of these benefit Paul himself? Yeah, well, for sure. His own spiritual welfare? Paul needed some kind of spiritual help? Yes, of course. Was that a selfish thing? Well, no, but were some of these benefiting others as well? Oh, wrong button. Did some benefit others? Yeah, most did, in the preaching of the gospel and strengthening and so on. But there's really one that's foundational. You see, it would never change. Whatever Paul decided to do, however it worked out, what would that be? What would always be the first thing that was the bottom of every decision that he made? Please God. And I think similarly, or right on top of that, is this thing called preaching Christ, saving other people, right? I believe that's there. So what I want to try to do is, let's see if we can put these in some kind of order. I think here are some incidental things at the top and more foundational things at the bottom. And you can arrange these however you want, but I think they're roughly in this order. Yeah, this will help me get to Spain, which, by the way, is really what I'm trying to do. You're on the way, but that's okay. Enjoy being refreshed by them. Be encouraged himself. Give spiritual gifts. Bear fruit in Rome, since I'm stopping there anyway. Preach in Rome while I'm there. Preach in new places like Spain. Now, you see, we're getting more to the core of Paul's mission as an apostle. Preach to Gentiles, which was his mission, according to what the Spirit told Ananias. And please God, as the foundational thing. Now, what I'm going to do is try to draw a picture. And I'm sorry, this is kind of probably an engineering or, you know, mathematical mindset, but maybe it will help you. Here's his decision structure. The most foundational element is this one thing. And I'll talk some more about the way this pyramid looks, but it's just a graphical representation where the most important things are at the bottom, right? And this is the same as the list on the other page just drawn. Two things about pleasing God, I think, are this. See if you agree with me. You can put them all in these two categories. Saving himself. Is that important to Paul? Maybe the most important, although at one point he said, I could wish myself a curse for my brethren, but that wasn't his choice to make. But saving others was the other thing, right? And I would tell you that there's a way in which everything in your life might relate just to those two things, if that's the most important thing to you, saving yourself and saving others. Now, how would he save himself and save others? What are some of the things you see in the decision that enable that? Well, he needed to grow and be encouraged himself as a Christian. That's part of saving himself, right? Maintaining strength and resisting temptation and all of that. I think he needed to strengthen others by being with them and worshiping. And he was also going to save others by preaching to non-Christians, especially in places where Christ had not been named. Do you see that what we're building here is a structure where those things on the bottom are the reasons for the things above? I'll come back to that in a minute. But if I was to ask you, why is Paul preaching to the Gentiles? And you, whenever I say the word why, read the block below. It's easy. Why is he preaching to Gentiles? Why is he trying to save others? You see how that works? I could ask it a different way. How is he planning to save others? And then you read up. How? Well, several things, but he's going to preach, he's going to strengthen others. You see how that works. Let's keep on going. How's he going to grow? Well, while he's in Rome, he's going to be refreshed and encouraged by the Romans. You see, isn't that what he's saying? So now the how and the why fit together. While he's in Rome, how's he going to strengthen others? He's going to preach to them. He's going to impart gifts while he's there. Would that be helpful for these whys down here? Why is he imparting gifts? Why? You see how that works. Keep going. Right? And he's going to be helped to go to Spain. Why does he want to go to Spain? Well, for that reason. And why does he want to do that? You see, it kind of builds up to that approach and so on. So on top of that whole thing, and by the way, being on the top means it's probably the lesser importance, right? Because the foundational things are below, at least the way I've built it. That's our convention. I've often wondered if I should turn this whole thing upside down, but I want the foundation, the bottom piece, to be. And I think our decisions in life really look more like this than they look like this, right? Because the details kind of go up and up. As a matter of fact, do you think there are other smaller decisions then that Paul had to make that would support the how of going to Rome? It's hard to kind of picture this, but do you imagine Paul walking around on the dock somewhere and just going by the ships? Are you going to Rome? Right? Are you going to Rome? When are you leaving? How long is it? Where else are you going on the way, you know? Are you a good navigator? You know, the questions like that. Anybody, do you have some like big, strong wicker baskets? I've got a lot of books, and I'm going to be on a long trip. I need something pretty strong that can withhold. You believe Paul would have been doing silly, detailed, ordinary things like that? I think he had to. How else would he do it? It's interesting to me, some of the details, especially with Luke's with them, of how the whole traveling thing works in those days. He stayed at Miletus. He was on a ship, right? And they were going to Jerusalem, but I believe he couldn't leave Miletus because if he did, the ship might leave while he was gone. So what did he do? He had the elders come meet him, and I think it's like, oh, are they packing up? You know, okay, no, listen, while I was with you, I labored night and day. Okay, you know, and I think he's worried that he might miss that. That may be the reason he came. I'm exaggerating, of course. But you see, there were little details in Paul's lives. And why was he buying wicker baskets and seeing about ships that go to Rome? Why was he doing that? Why? Well, I'm trying to get to Rome. Why? And work your way down. Can you imagine this? Even to little decisions in Paul's life that are really not in and of themselves. Okay, and so I've said this already. If I ask you why, how, then you can read up, and I'll ask you why. It's really the same question. Then you can read down. Can you imagine a different structure of a life? Remember we talked about there are two mindsets, flesh and spirit. What would be at the bottom of a different, fleshly, not led by the Spirit, whose God is their belly? What would a different structure, same pyramid kind of, but what would be on the bottom, do you think? Pleasing yourself, pleasure, something like that. Let's see if we can't build one of those. I've mentioned this, I forgot to say this, I said it, but so the things on the bottom are least likely to change. And why hadn't he gone to Rome before? I think it just didn't support the larger goals, the more important goals down below, right? And I think if something happened up here that didn't support the ones down here, those blocks would be taken away. So let's look at another example, guided by the flesh. At the very bottom, their God is their belly. Pleasure, be happy, would be at the very bottom. People really don't live that way, do they? Make major decisions on what they think would make them happiest. I hear that all the time. Is the reason to leave a marriage, to form a marriage, right? To take a job. In fact, I am sorry to say that I think that way sometimes. And I think we all, in our language, we kind of show that we're thinking in that way a little bit. Somebody gets a new job, right? And they move to the city and they get the new job. What's the first thing we ask them when we meet them? Haven't seen them in a while. What do we say? Do you like your job? What's implied in that? Is that the most important thing to ask about a job? Do we like it? I sometimes imagine kind of going back in time to the Depression. There's some old guy out on the farm behind the mule plowing that dry dirt. You know what I mean? For 12 hours, as long as the sun was up, he's out there trying to just jerk some kind of food out of the soil, and you go up and say, do you like your job? You know, that's not a question to ask. The question is, are you able to survive on the job? Or is this the thing you need to be doing the most important? You see what I'm saying? But we do that. In fact, when this is over, this whole session, you might say, I really enjoyed that Marty's preaching. Okay. You see what I'm not going to quit. I hope you do say that, by the way. You're welcome to say that. But do you see how that kind of, it tends a little bit toward this thinking. Why were you here? Because it was so much fun. Oh, so entertaining, right? Good speaker, all that. Is that the reason we're here? Because it's fun, pleasurable, entertaining? And so what happens if it isn't, but it's still edifying? It's teaching that I really need. What happens? That's a question to ask. But I'm afraid sometimes in the world we live in, this is the way we think. Well, how can I be happy? Well, you know, you've got to have toys. I mean adult toys. Why do we have them? Are they wrong? Right. Yeah. Are they wrong? Yeah. Show me a verse where it says this. We want to do fun things. Vacations. Hunting, fishing, camping, hiking. And you know, we need fun friends to be with to do those. You're aware of that, right? A lot of things are much more fun, especially if those friends enjoy the same things we enjoy, right? And I need the deepest pleasure perhaps in the world, in life, is a sexual activity of some kind. To have things, I got to get money. And I probably need some degree of rights or power or freedom or something to be able to exercise and do and go where I want to go and be with whom I want to be with. And so I'll have other relationships, right? For fun friends and others. I have to form some of those. And I might actually marry and have a family. Are you ready? Why would I marry and have a family? Why would I marry and have a family? You remember why? What's my why in this structure of things? They're beautiful. Pleasure. They're beautiful. I can't imagine living without them. They're so much fun. We're just best friends. We love to do all the same things. Right? You hear that kind of thing? They just make me happy. People don't marry just for that reason, do they? That's the why. Well, let's keep going. I'm married, have a family. Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to block that out. And so to get money and power, Hal reads up, I have good investments, good income. I want to be popular so I can kind of have those good friends and have some measure of power and influence. And I'd like to meet people. Why? Well, some of them I might want to marry, but I have other relationships and friends that I have. How will I meet people? How will I be popular? How will I have good investments? I need a good job. I need a good investment in a large house. And I might be involved in civic service. Why would I do that? Why reads down? Why? I'm just service-oriented or what? In this model, anyway. It's a place you might get some power and you might meet some sales contacts, you know, and, you know, that's just something. You know how to network. You know, networking is a big deal if you really want to succeed in life in this way. I would join clubs. And guess what? Would I actually maybe join a church in this model? Y'all are getting sleepy, I think. Remember, I think we covered this Friday night. Do this. Just. Would this person be in a church? And if so, why? Why? Why would they be in a church? Here's another way to ask the question. Suppose things in that church got unpleasant and the people were just kind of like, you know, geeks and weird people and stuff. And they had some kind of problem, some squabble over a Bible issue or something that's unpleasant. What might I do? Why wouldn't I? It's an upper block. It's not supporting anymore those lower blocks. Those are less permanent, right? The upper ones, if they're not working out, you replace them with something different. That's why Paul didn't go to Rome for a long time. He wanted to go. It was a good thing. But it really didn't support what he was trying to do in a more fundamental level. And so, how do I get a good job? Man, I get the best degree from the best university in a job that's going to have high demand and I can demand a high salary and have great job security and so on. And I'm going to stay healthy. Why am I staying healthy? Because I need to do a lot of fun things. And I need to be involved in a lot of activities. That's the reason. Besides that, it doesn't hurt to look pretty buff, you know? When you're trying to meet people and have good sexual partners and all that, you really need to be in shape. That's an advantage, isn't it? So why am I healthy? And so on. Can you see this picture? Do you know anybody like this? And I'll just tell you, is this all that disrespectable in the world to live with this kind of a value system? I don't think so. I think it's kind of presented as that's the way you ought to make decisions. If you're not happy, move out. Do something different. Get a new wife if she's not making you happy. Right? And that's the way it works. The upper blocks are dependent on the other. For our time, for our modern time, what would it look like as a spirit-led decision structure? Well, I think the same two bottom blocks would be there as Paul, right? What's our foundational purpose as Christians? Please God. It isn't to be happy. It might make us happy. We'd be filled with joy, I think, but that's really not even the motive. We make it our aim to be well-pleasing to God. And I think the same two blocks on top of that probably apply as well. So how do I please Him? Well, I do whatever I can to make sure I can save myself first, but also others, save others as well. So how might I do that? Let's think about it. I need to find a way to grow and be spiritually encouraged. And I'm not going to go up, but I could. Can you guess what kind of blocks would be above this when I'm asking the question, how are you going to grow and be encouraged spiritually? How will you do that? Can you think of some things that would be hows of that? I'll be studying. I'll be praying. Would I be with other Christians? Well, Paul did. He needed to be encouraged. That's one of the things he was going to enjoy about being at Rome, was it helped establish that. We'll get there. I would want to care for others as part of saving the others. I'd want to find opportunity to edify others as part of helping them and teaching others. I would have personal devotion, as you mentioned. I'd work in a church. I might even marry. But now I'm going to ask the why question, which reads down. Why would I marry? Just decide to marry at all.
Why would I? In this picture.
Why would I? I want somebody that will grow, that help me grow and be spiritually encouraged. That's one thing, right? And whatever else is, I want an opportunity to edify another person. Take them with me. An opportunity to teach them as well, right? And encourage them. And you'll find some other things above there that marriage, that getting married is enabled by. But that's a reason for Mary. Is that a different reason from what we saw before? And here's another way to think about it. Are these down here likely to change if you remain a Christian and are going to try to be serving God your whole life? In which case, really, the stable base for this marriage is always going to pretty much be the same. But let's keep talking. Would you have children? Why would you have children? To keep up with the next door neighbors? To provide grandparents to the grandchildren to the impatient grandparents? Is that the reason? No, it's for the same reasons and so on. So I would have friends. And I would actually build my skills. Why? Because they may be useful in the service to God. They will be. I need to make them useful, including supporting a family or working in a church or having a good mind so that I can do Bible study and Bible teaching. I need to be able to care and support that family that I've kind of volunteered to have for good reasons down here, right? I would have spiritual activities. I need to build some time in for those. I need social activities. Let's keep going. I would get training so I could build my skills. I might even go to college. Why? Why reads down? I'd have a job. Why? What's the purpose of your job? I need to be fulfilled in life. This is something that bothers me. Is there some sense that if somebody doesn't get to work or work outside the home, they're somehow missing out on some of life's fulfillment? So anyway, my question is, why do we have a job? Well, read down. So I can do this because I made a decision to do that. That enables this, so I can do this. A lot of reasons to have a job besides just it makes me happy or feeling fulfilled. I might have a house. Would it have influenced the kind of house I bought? And where I built that house and how big some of the rooms were, right? Would it? Would it change the nature of the house for sure? Because the why of that house is different than in the other view, right? In the other view, I need about 14 garages for all my toys, right? In this room, I need a large room where all the folks can gather for Bible studies and devotions, right? As an example, it would change that. Okay, would I stay healthy in this system? Why? Well, because all of these things here have some kind of health requirement, right? Physical capability. But the reason is not so I look buff, but because I have things to do. And I would develop social skills, and I might go to school to get that training, and I might learn life skills, and I might exercise. Why? To stay healthy so I can why all the way down here. And I might have even recreation and hobbies, but why? I just love it. Or maybe it has larger purposes of meeting people for these reasons, right? Or developing some of my skills that can be put to use for the Lord and so on. This maybe seems extreme, but I think about that. Is it possible that you could even take the smallest decision you've made and link it together somehow and end up down here at the bottom? I think that's what God wants me to do, by reasoning through why we do these things. Some of you took the long way to the building. Some of you took a shortcut. Why? And I don't know. And I'll stop and warn you at this point, we'll say more about it later, that I need to stop saying that because somebody held me accountable that I didn't come back to something I said I would say more about later. But anyway, and then I forgot what I was going to say. So that... That will shorten the lesson a little bit. Look at this guy. Who is this? Is he healthy? Married? Got a good job? Respectable? Member of a church? right? Is everybody likes him? You see, this is what we actually see in people. You know what I mean? But really, I don't know what's down below. I really don't know what blocks are down below. I can maybe see some symptoms. And sometimes when there are tests that some of these things don't quite fulfill the blocks below, and I see, you know what? He's having trouble in his marriage, and the reason he's married is this for that, and now I understand why he is divorcing his wife. I'm sorry, it's all men here doing these bad things, but you see what I'm saying here. There's some indication when you make a decision how this value system is structured. But for the most part, if all I see is this, I don't really know. But one person knows, besides God, and that's me. And here's what I was meant to say a while ago. I got to it after all. And now I don't have to come back to it either because I'm going to say it. If I can remember now what it was. Do you understand this does not make things easier in some ways? Oh, yeah, it kind of puts things in context and all that. But I think one of the most difficult things I have to do is to really figure out what is that block below. What am I really thinking? Oh, I can tell a great story. That's why I have this job, so I can go and help the church in that city. Now, it doesn't hurt that I'm making twice as much as I make now, right? And that church really doesn't need my help, and I'm not helping at all in the church I'm in right now. But it's a good story, right? That's why I'm going. You see how we can sometimes fool ourselves. So now I've transferred the problem really in a way to saying, well, it doesn't matter. It's an area of freedom, and we don't know how to make the decision. Well, here's how to make a decision. But now my self-awareness is the challenge, I think. And so I'm trying to tell you, I'm not simplifying your life, but I am transforming the problem into another issue, which is what are we thinking when we make these decisions? That's the hard part. But it can be done. So what makes a good decision? Well, everybody else agreed with that decision. I asked a bunch of people, and they all said, yeah, that's a good decision. Is that what makes it right in God's sight? Well, probably not. Now, it could be that you ask the right people, and they have a spiritual view of things, and that's pretty good advice. But in general, whether it's popular in the world or not, is not the way we should decide what's right or wrong. You know how we usually judge decisions? You do know. How do we usually judge them? I'll give you an example. This is a football. Sorry for the women, but I think you probably understand it. Football game. Ball on the other team's 40-yard line, just out of field goal range, right? Early in the fourth quarter, 4th and 1. You guys got the setting there? What's your choice? Hear them? You hear them? They all know. Thank you. And by the way, often that independence is kind of reading the pyramid downward, really. It depends on what you're thinking. Why? We'll come back to that. I promise I will. But the coach, the next morning, well, the coach will make a decision, right? And guess what? He'll be judged by the next day. Only one thing. Did they make it? If they went for it, right? Or if they didn't, did they get the 3 points and that turned out to help the rest? You know what I mean? It's the outcome of the decision, right? Now, the fact that the team had practiced all week long on a special secret play, specially designed by watching all the films of the other team and knowing that they could exploit a vulnerability that defensive tackle was injured and that rookie is right in that spot. You know what I mean? It was well thought out. They practiced it. They got it 9 out of 10 times. It was perfectly, flawlessly executed all week in practice for just this situation. And the coach says, we're going for it. Does all that matter the next morning if they didn't make it? I'm sorry it doesn't. That's just not the way the world works. And I'd ask you this question. Paul went to Jerusalem and he got arrested. And he was in Caesarea for 2 straight years, not going to Rome. And when he got to Rome, he wasn't doing all that stuff he was talking about. He was in, well, a hired house, but he was in prison. Did his plans change in those upper blocks? We don't know that he got to Spain ever. Ever. But you know, is it possible that those lower blocks, pleasing God and preaching, saving self and others, and even preaching to Gentiles, He figured out a way to do that even when he was in prison. Totally different pyramid by then, right? All those upper blocks had been rearranged, but the bottom one stayed the same. And did he preach to people? Gentiles in Rome, like maybe in Caesar's household, the Praetorian Guard and other things? Yeah, he managed to still accomplish those. And that's the why, of, in a sense, of what he was doing when he was in Rome. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's outcome. And here's some Bible thinking about that. The lot is cast into the lap. And I think we think things are random. Do you realize you kids are thinking about, you know, you use the word random differently nowadays. I think random now means I don't understand it. Right? This random person came up. There are no random people. You know what I mean? And not only that, they came up with a reason. That something happened in their life, you know, that led them to be there. It wasn't random. But anyway, you use that word however you want. It's fine with me. But what we think is random really is an expression of our ignorance. I can flip a coin and it might be heads or tails, and you think it's random, but if I knew the inertial rotation and the height of the fall and the way it came down and the center of gravity and what the surface was it fell on, and if I knew all the physics, would it really even be random? No, it's not. I wonder if somebody in the world, but not, is there some person somewhere that knows what will happen no matter what kind of lot is cast into the lap? God knows all those details. The hairs of my head have numbers on them in His mind. The decision is from the Lord, but it's not in your head to know. So don't start judging yourself because a decision you made just lost you a lot of money. The job was a disaster. I picked the wrong contractor to build the house, and it's been a heartache and headache ever since. Maybe I even married a person who didn't turn out to be the kind of person I wanted them to be. That's not the basis of making a decision, good or bad, in the sense of right or wrong in God's sight, is it? What is it? You can kind of tell where we're going with this. Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it's the Lord's purpose that prevails. Come now, you who say tomorrow, today or tomorrow, we'll go into such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. You don't know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? It's a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. Yeah, you make decisions, but you realize the tentative nature of the way they're going to turn out. No, it isn't how they turn out. And let us not judge ourselves or others by how some of the events in our life turn out. I think I can be hard on myself when I do something. I think, man, did I waste a lot of money there? That's really not the reason it's a bad decision. It may be bad, but it may be it's for some other reason. And what would that be? The real reason, it seems like, is this simple question. Why did you decide to do that? What is the reason behind it? And you remember that reads down in the block structure. And so when someone says, you know, well, in fact, we can kind of think about that. If you're not thinking this way, here's the kind of mindset. These are kind of thoughts you'll have. I don't see anything wrong with this. No harm done. I'm not hurting anyone. It's not hurting myself. It's just a matter of judgment. It doesn't have anything to do with my service to God. And it makes me happy. And I really just don't like doing that thing. And I don't think I should be required to. This is this lady. I think her name is Shirley. She shows up occasionally. And Shirley says, surely God doesn't require that of me. You know, or surely it's not wrong to do this or that. She's kind of a... Watch out for her because I have a right. It's my personal business. Nobody would expect me. Everybody else is doing it. I don't see any Bible verse that says it's wrong. That's too fanatical. You've got to have balance in your life. Surely, there she is again, God wouldn't expect me to do this or that. So-and-so does it, and it worked out well for them. Worked out well in what sense? Well, the outcomes were good. That's not the way we judge decisions, you see. So now I'm ready to give you the answer to all these questions. In fact, you probably already know what it is. Do you think it's a sin to take one drink of alcohol? What would you say? It's actually almost like a one-word answer. Why would you do it? And that forces us to think downward in that block and say, what am I trying to accomplish by doing that? What positive thing am I accomplishing that somehow relates itself to saving myself and saving others? Can we think in those terms? Let's practice. Do you think it would be, let's pick one out here. Do you think it's a sin to get a tattoo? That's This is not hard. How would you answer that question? Why would you do it? And it really begins to ask the real heart of the question is what's behind it? What are you trying to accomplish? Be like other people? Be more popular? Send some message? I don't know. Maybe it somehow helps you in serving God. I don't know that story, but it's conceivable, I guess. Do you think it's wrong, a sin, to date a non-Christian? Y'all know the answer now, right? There's just one answer to all these questions. Why would you do it? Why? And the question is a little bit like, Paul, why are you trying to get to Rome? Why is that so important to you? Do you think he'd have answered that question? Yeah, he had good reasoning behind it. Because he had thought through what his mission in life was and how he was going to accomplish that in strategic, you know, plans overall. And then those kinds of little issues, they weren't hard to decide about because they had a context, a reason for them. And if the reason that to date a non-Christian or marry a non-Christian, I just love them so much. What else can I do? I can't imagine life without them. They make me happy. Which block set are we on here? There's only two ways of making this decision, mind of the flesh and mind of the spirit. What are we thinking in those terms? I'm not saying it's a sin. You see what I'm saying, though. And so the challenge becomes figuring out why am I making these decisions. You see that? And that's where I'm going to try to end up here. Why would you do it is the answer. And you know, when God judges us, it's not whether we made that first down on fourth and one in that tough call, even though we had all the right motives and we messed it up. And I'm sure he doesn't judge Paul on the fact that he got arrested. He never made it to Spain as far as we know. Maybe he did after that first imprisonment. Yeah, Paul might have thought himself a failure because he didn't get to do that plan, but I don't think so. God judges the heart. He judges the why. Interesting, in Luke 16, Jesus told the parable. It's a little bit of a puzzling parable about the unjust steward. You remember that parable? Man had a position. He had control of his master's house, but he kind of figured out, I'm about to get fired. What shall I do? Right? Remember that? And he made good decisions about, I don't know if they're ethical or not. They might have been. He might have had the right to do it. But he settled up with the master's debtors in a way that he made friends with those people, and he would have a job once he lost it. And Jesus made the application. You need to use what you have in this life to make friends for your next life. That's kind of what he's saying. That was the application. A little difficult parable. But there were some folks listening in who were lovers of money. And Jesus said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men. He's talking to the Jewish people who kind of ridiculed what he said. That's the silliest thing we've ever heard. But what he said was, you look pretty good before other people. Let's say the top of your pyramid. But God knows your hearts. What's highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. What a radical way of thinking about that. And clearly in the context of financial decisions and things that had to do with what we do in this life. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. That should strike some fear into us when we make decisions. And it should change the way we make them. You've probably seen the thing where you put all the pros on one column and all the cons on the other when you got a tough decision to make. And you add them all up, and this one's 13 and this one's 14, so I guess we'll do this. Right? I think that's missing the point. I don't know how do you score it? Maybe the point, right? What makes this a 5 and this a 4? Does it support our spiritual goals is maybe the question. And maybe a better algorithm, if you will, would be to try to draw a pyramid and see what the reasons are behind it. What larger goals in life does it support? That's the why, and I believe that's how God will judge us. I'll end with this verse, and then we'll sing the invitation song. This is in Jeremiah 17. It's just a great passage, chapter. And he says this, which frightens me. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? What a challenge. I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. I'm going to squeeze this in. Thank you so much for listening this weekend. I really appreciate it. But you see where we've ended is to be able to look in our hearts and say, why are we doing everything we're doing? As a family member, as a church member, as a Christian, as a member of the community, a citizen of this country, what is motivating us? What's driving us? Because that's what God judges and that's what God sees. If you're not a Christian, I don't think there's a question about where on the pyramid you are. You haven't really put that first block in place, which is to be submissive to God and making pleasing Him the center of your life. And so this is a true, real invitation that I've probably failed to do all week, but I'm giving it to you now. It's not to come be a member of this church or a club of people who love to study the Bible. That's not it. It's not that. It's pleasing God as the heart. And He's made a great plan that you can be a part of to enable you to do that. And then set about in your life to build a structure that's built on pleasing God as its foundation. And anyway, let's stand and sing and think about changes all of us can make when we do that.